Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has not only had, for a long period of time, an admirable record of applying intelligence, he's also worked in the intelligence space for many years. In the United States government, he is Daniel Gallington. He served as the last bipartisan general counsel of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He worked in the Defense Department. He worked at the Department of Justice in various realms, including Homeland Security as well as intelligence. He is one of our duty experts on all these matters. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Dan Gallington, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be with you. I really look forward to the day.
Thank you. Well, let me talk to you a little bit about something that's happened by the time this program airs. It's not yet happened as we speak, Dan, but it involves Mike Pompeo, a former member of Congress, currently the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who has been nominated, as you know, by the president to be the next Secretary of State. He is being subjected to the tortures of the damned by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Having worked up there on Capitol Hill for some time, you know that to be a committee that is generally leans to the left, I think it's fair to say. It looks as though, as we speak, he will not get the votes he needs because all of the Democrats will vote against him, including two who voted for him previously for the CIA position, and Rand Paul, a Republican senator. Assuming that's true, what happens next, and does it matter if he gets ultimately confirmed by the full Senate?
Well, you know, if that happens, it's indeed a sad day for our democracy, because Mike Pompeo is probably the best qualified nominee for that job when you consider the time and the events of the day and the issues of the day. He's absolutely the best guy for it. He has served in Congress. He's a West Pointer. He's sharp in national defense issues. He's been director of the CIA for a pivotal period of time. And he has acted as the president's personal rep in some preliminary negotiations, discussions with the North Koreans. What a shame. I guess my reaction is sort of with your introduction to the question, what a shame that we can't get a guy like this confirmed when we need him so badly.
Yeah, well, I think we will ultimately get him confirmed, but it will apparently be with a negative report by the committee. But what do you think is motivating that, Dan? As you say, on the face of it, this is an eminently qualified man. He's a man who has acquitted himself well in each of these incarnations as an Army officer, as a businessman, as a member of Congress, on the Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives, by the way, and then as the director of Central Intelligence Agency. I can't figure it, but there seems to be a fairly substantial dose of partisan politics involved. Are you shocked to discover that?
I am kind of with this nomination, because here's a guy who's eminently qualified, as you mentioned, comes from the HPSI, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Who better to do this job at this time? I think it has to be partisan politics. It has to be the idea that the Democrats perhaps don't want to see Trump succeed, and they look at Pompeo as a vehicle for his success in dealing with an extremely complex international situation with North Korea. And as much as I hate to say it, they don't the opposition appears to be more centered on preventing success than it does anything else. I can't imagine any other reason.
Which is all the more stunning, since it's obviously not just the success of this president, it's the success of the nation. That's the thing that's really scandalous. Hey, let me turn to a different topic. Last year, as I recall, you wrote a column for the Washington Times, Dan Gallington, in which you warned that Jim Comey, the then former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, may well be getting himself in trouble over these memoranda recording, according to his lights, conversations he had with President Trump. They've now been made public late last week. There's been a considerable thrashing going on to make sense of them. Do you think your warnings have been now borne out? And if so, to what end?
Well, yeah, we're right on the money. I mean, my suggestion in the op-ed last year was, look, what he did was to write an internal memo about a conversation he had with the president. Nothing wrong with that, provided you handle it the way those kind of things are supposed to be handled. That is, he writes the memo. He's a classification authority because he's the director. He classifies the paragraphs as appropriate. And he turns it in to the IG, or he turns it in to the central office there in the FBI. But no. He took these memos, which, if you look at, are clearly government records, with paragraphs marked and all that. He took these memos and he handed them off to his friend, former FBI guy, or former U.S. attorney guy, with the intention that the guy then passed them to the media, to the New York Times, which happened. Now, if you had done something like that, or I had done something like that when we were working for the government, we would be prosecuted for any number of technical and substantive violations of the law. You know, when I write an op-ed, I have to submit it to the PRB, and it's a good procedure because it protects me from inadvertently saying something in one of my op-eds that's maybe classified.
Well, I'm a little shocked that it's playing out in the way it has, Dan, but it's only one element of what really seems to be the unraveling of Jim Comey as a man who at a time at least was a pretty highly respected, you know, national security and law enforcement professional. And it's kind of a tragic situation. Again, the partisanship that is much in evidence in official Washington these days is in full play here, I think it's fair to say. But still, just as a human being, there's a certain pathos to it that I fear is probably an indicator of the further erosion of confidence in our critical institutions like the FBI. Dan Gallington, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. I look forward to doing so on an early opportunity, and I appreciate your time today. Come back to us again very soon if you would. Next up, we are joined by Gordon Chang. We'll talk about North Korea, much in the news at the moment as well, and what's coming up next there, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, our duty expert and, well, that of much of the free world, on matters involving Asia. He is a contributor to the Daily Beast and Fox News. He is the author of two tremendously important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, a topic we're very keen to talk with you about. Once again, Gordon Chang, welcome back. Thanks to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank, and you're much too kind.
No, anyway.
Not at all. All true and well-deserved. Let me ask you, Gordon, to give us a quick sense of where you think things are with respect to the diplomatic attention now being paid to this North Korea that has taken on the world. Let's start with the latest developments in terms of a prospective summit meeting between Kim Jong-un of North Korea and President Trump. Some concessions, we're told, have been made to get this thing going. Is that how you see it?
Well, certainly Kim Jong-un has made concessions. It is not the style of the Kim regime to make concessions before negotiations begin. So we are seeing something different. But there's also something which is old. So, for instance, in 2008, we saw Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, blow up the cooling tower for North Korea's only nuclear reactor at Yongbin. And everyone said, oh, great, the North Koreans are serious about disarming. But in 2009, the North Koreans just completely walked away from the six-party talks. So we could be seeing the same sort of dynamic here with Kim Jong-un, the son. But, you know, a lot of people say, well, the North Korea won't do this or North Korea won't do that. And that's clearly true under current incentives. But this is not a North Korea question. This is not a question of what Kim Jong-un wants. This really is an issue of what President Trump will let him get away with. We have the power to disarm North Korea short of the use of force. And of course, with the use of force, we can certainly disarm the North. So this is a question of overwhelming power that President Trump has. And it's an issue of whether he is willing to use that power. So we should be stopped talking about what Kim wants or what Kim will do and talk about what Trump wants and what Trump is willing to do.
Yeah. You know, I think the president, to his credit, has been trying to make sure that people understand that's the dynamic as he sees it as well, Gordon Chang. And it's refreshing. I mean, there's an awful temptation on the part of leaders to believe that the personal chemistry and charm and so on will offset all of the bad history with dictators like Kim Jong-un and his family. But when the president says, you know, this may not work out, and if it's not going to be conducive to it working out, I'm not going. And if I'm there and it isn't working out, I'm not staying. I mean, these are the kinds of, it seems to me, signals that need to be sent. How do you see it?
Yes, I think the most important thing that President Trump said at the conclusion of his two-day meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is exactly what you pointed out, Frank, and that is that if President Trump feels that the negotiations with the North Koreans are not going to be fruitful, he's not going to go. If during the middle of those negotiations he feels that the North Koreans are not acting in good faith, he'll leave. And that's important because the problem we've had with negotiations with the North Koreans in the past is that we've tried too hard to get a deal. That's certainly true of the agreed framework in 1994, and it's been true in the Bush and the Obama administrations. So I found it refreshing for Trump to say that. I know that he's gotten some criticism for it, but absolutely true. And this is true not just for North Korea. This is true for everything that we do, all of our interactions with other countries. There are very few times where we should not walk away from the table, extremely few. And certainly with regard to North Korea, we've got to be willing to make the North Koreans understand that they've got to deal with the international community in good faith or they won't get what they want. And that's just elemental.
It is elemental, and unfortunately, though, as you say, it has been mostly not practiced by successive U.S. governments, Republican as well as Democratic. You talk about striving for a deal. Unfortunately, it's often been the case, as you know so well, Gordon Chang, it's been a deal on the terms of the North Koreans, which has always proven to be a chimera, I think. I want to come back to the Trump-Abe meeting with you, but before we do, Gordon, this approach does not seem to be on display with respect to President Moon of South Korea and his summit meeting that will take place a little later this week with the North Korean dictator. What do you expect will come of that? We're hearing talk of a peace agreement to replace the armistice ending, or at least pausing the North Korean-South Korean war. Tell us what you think is in the offing there.
Yeah. The South Koreans have made it clear that they would like a declaration after the meeting of both Moon and Kim that they intend to work for a peace treaty to formally conclude the Korean War. In other words, to replace the armistice. Now, there are not the only parties to this. Of course, the UN command and China were two of the three parties that signed the armistice, the third being North Korea. South Korea actually refused to sign the armistice. And clearly, you know, this is something that's going to happen, I think. Although getting it to a peace treaty could be difficult, the South Koreans are going to drive this, and they're probably going to agree things that they shouldn't. So, for instance, they'll probably agree to a formal treaty without requiring the North Koreans to pull back their formidable forces that are forward deployed on the demilitarized zone. So that would be a mistake. I'm sure Moon Jae-in, who doesn't like the United States, sees a peace treaty as a preliminary step to breaking South Korea's alliance with the United States. Moon is now trying to amend the South Korean constitution so it is more compatible with North Korea's, because he wants a formal merger of North and South Korea into one Korean state, probably ending up with a loose confederation in the beginning. Moon is very pro-North Korean. His advisors are extremely pro-North Korean. So we've got to be more concerned about Moon than we do about Kim Jong-un in this case. But we have the power to box Moon in, and Trump has been pretty successful during the time in office in making sure the South Korean doesn't get too far off the range.
Well, this sounds like his agenda is very far off the range, Gordon Chang. It also sounds as though it would not sit well with an awful lot of South Koreans. Is that still the case, or have things changed to the point now where this kind of accommodation, which I must tell you, it seems to me would almost certainly be read by Kim Jong-un as an invitation to, assert himself even more forcefully in the South. What do you think the public in South Korea feels about all this?
I think most of the public in South Korea is not on board with President Moon's plans. You have the older South Koreans who remember the American sacrifice during the Korean War, are very pro-American. And you have younger South Koreans who believe that their country is South Korea, Republic of Korea. It's not Korea. Moon Jae-in belongs to the 386 generation. He's now 65, who fought for democracy in South Korea. And they incorrectly view the U.S. as the opponent of their efforts. He is from a time where many South Koreans do feel the way that he does. So the South Korean electorate, if you want to think of it, is sort of like a donut with Moon in the middle. And he is boxed in both by older and younger South Koreans who don't want to see the accomplishment of his goals with regard to unification. You know, if you talk to South Koreans and say, generally, would unification be a good idea? I think they might say yes, but only on the terms of South Korea. What's different about Moon is that he wants to have unification, and he's willing to make fundamental compromises to do it. I don't think most South Koreans are on board with that.
Well, let's hope that boxing him in will be both his own public and President Trump, because this does seem to me it's fraught with peril. Gordon, I did want to come back to the president's meeting with Prime Minister Abe of Japan this past week. You indicated that Trump has brought Japan into the closest relationship ever. This is important, particularly against the backdrop of something I talked about with our colleague Bill Gertz of the Washington Times and Free Beacon last week, namely the testimony of the nominee to become the next commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, Admiral Philip Davidson, to the effect that China now has effectively, short of war, that's an important caveat, but short of war, control of the South China Sea as a result of these now militarized islands that we've been discussing have been a building for some time. And if war happens, that it might not come out right for the United States. What are your thoughts, and did these considerations factor in, as best we can tell, to the conversation between the president and Prime Minister Abe?
Yeah, I don't think Abe was that concerned about the South China Sea in his discussions with President Trump last week, but he is in general concerned about the South China Sea, and more than his predecessors has talked about Japan's interest in that body of water. With regard to Admiral Davidson's comments, I don't think the Chinese control the South China Sea at this point, short of war. And I'm concerned about this talk because it creates a certain amount of pessimism, which you will find in a fair number of Navy officers, that there's no point in opposing the Chinese because they've already won. That's a very dangerous view, which is prevalent in the Navy. And I think that clearly we need to understand that this is not just the United States. This is a lot of other countries that have interests in the South China Sea, including Japan, who are willing to oppose the Chinese. When it comes to your second question about war in the South China Sea and maybe it not coming out right, yeah, that's a real possibility. We could lose a war in the South China Sea for a lot of reasons. But let's not be think that we're chopped liver, because that is a view that China tries to propagate, that they already control this, that it's theirs, and that we should just get out. And so I believe that we should understand that, yes, they do have a lot of assets in the South China Sea, but so do we.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Next up, Ambassador Henry Cooper will join us. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by an old friend and much valued colleague, Ambassador Henry Cooper. Hank Cooper was the, among other things, the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under George Herbert Walker Bush. Prior to that time, he served as an ambassador in the defense and space talks for President Ronald Reagan. I had the privilege of working with him in a couple of different capacities at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, at the in the United States Air Force, where he served both in uniform and on the civilian side, as well as in the defense and space talks. He is these days the chairman of an extraordinarily important organization, High Frontier, and a senior associate of the inestimably important National Institute for Public Policy. Hank Cooper, it's so good to have you back with us. Welcome, sir. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Frank. Anytime.
Well, let me ask you about the topic that I was discussing a moment ago with Gordon Chang. Hank, you've had a lot of experience in both the old-fashioned kinetic side of the business as well as the arms control and negotiations side. Talk a little bit about how this threat from North Korea is shaping up and your assessment of the prospects of really mitigating it through what amounts to, I guess, to arms control, and the need to back up whatever we do in that vein with missile defenses in the event that past experience pans out to be our future as well, namely violated agreements and bad behavior from the North.
Well, Frank, let me just say that, you know, almost a year ago, the intelligence community concluded that North Korea already had, could have had, up to 60 nuclear weapons at that point. And some of them were acknowledged to be very low-yield weapons, and that was considered by many to suggest they still had a lot of work to do. I do not share that view because I believe North Korea should have could have specially designed super EMP weapons that could be placed on the ballistic missiles they have. And at the time, a year ago, they had demonstrated they could reach Guam, which is a U.S. territory, Hawaii, and in fact, all of the states of the United States.
Now, this would, of course, be electromagnetic pulse weapons, and these are of such concern because they, even a single weapon could conceivably do incalculable damage to our electric grid. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that's a capability that Kim Jong-un has said was a strategic goal. And that's a quote, unquote, strategic goal of their plan. So We should not ignore it. And regrettably, everybody who talks about this problem still is suggesting that, well, no problem, because North Korea hasn't yet developed the capability to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere with sufficient accuracy to hit a city. And that may or may not be true, but they don't have to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and they certainly don't need accuracy to set off a nuclear weapon over the United States, which is all EMP. So North Korea already has this capability, and I don't believe they're going to negotiate it away. That's my own personal view. So in the negotiations that we undertake, and as you know, I'm well acquainted with negotiating history. My role during the Reagan years in Geneva was to find creative ways to say yet, I like to say, because the Soviets wanted to give away our SDI in exchange for the agreements that Reagan wanted. We ultimately withstood that. And regrettably, the Clinton administration, when they came in, took the real benefits on the defense side away. We really need that now to support our negotiations with North Korea.
And more to the point, to protect ourselves in the event that, as has been the case in the past, they fail to honor whatever agreements they might make with President Trump. Let me ask you in that regard, Ambassador Cooper, you have for many years been an advocate for, and in fact, a serious enabler of the idea of putting into place on our ships equipped with the Aegis air defense system, the capability to protect both the fleet and the rest of us against ballistic missiles as well. What should we be doing in that regard to hedge against the possibility of a breakdown or further bad behavior by the North Koreans and others for that matter?
We should make Aegis all it can be, which has the inherent capability of shooting down ballistic missiles in their ascent phase. They have to be outside the Earth's atmosphere. But if we can track the missiles within the atmosphere before they leave the atmosphere and cue our interceptors on board our ships today, and Japan's ships, by the way, as well, then those ships can intercept North Korea's missiles on their way up. And we should be giving them the capability as quickly as possible. At the same time, we can use existing capabilities on our fighter aircraft flown by Marines, Air Force, and Navy pilots, and they're available in the region, to use an air-to-air missile that is well-tested and deployed around the world to shoot down North Korea's missiles in their boost phase if the pilot's prepared to go into harm's way. And I've been assured that they are prepared if we simply plan to engage in that way. So I hope the United States Air Force and our leaders are planning to do that to provide a defense against the existing capabilities North Korea already has. If we do that, I think that would be an aid in the negotiations that Donald Trump has undertaken. And he has said, you know, he's prepared to leave if they don't go the way they should go. And I believe one of his conditions has to be that we're going to defend against ballistic missiles in that region of the world, his and China's and, you know, Kim Jong-un's and China's and others who might threaten us.
Too. One other way that you've recommended, two that I'd like to have you touch on, if you could, quickly, Ambassador Henry Cooper. One is to use what are called remotely piloted aircraft as a possible platform that wouldn't entail sending men into harm's way in places like North Korea's defended airspace. And also space-based capabilities. You worked manfully to bring those to pass during your time in the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization. What are our options in both of those regards to do this critically important boost phase missile defense mission?
Well, I believe that if we give the money to the folks at General Atomics, they can adapt their Predator to remotely piloted aircraft. They can fly at high altitude and shoot down missiles in their boost phase as well. That's a capability, to the best of my knowledge, we do not have today, but I believe we could have within a year's time, maybe even in months' time. I don't know what exactly the state of the art is.
Especially with our friends at General Atomics proving to be pretty adaptive, that they would bring this to bear very rapidly if they were given the go-ahead. And in terms of space, Brilliant Pebbles was an option 2 decades ago. I assume with the march of technology, this could be done even better and more inexpensively today. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And just to remind people, we had a fully approved program by the acquisition authorities of the Pentagon, not just the SDI, that had been fully costed out, that would have cost like $10 billion in 1988 dollars, which translates to $20 billion today, to develop it, build it, deploy it, and operate it for 20 years. So $20 billion could give us a Brilliant Pebbles constellation today that could, with high confidence, destroy up to 200 attacking missiles from anywhere in the world before they could reach the United States.
Powerful enhancer of our deterrent force, that's for sure.
People are talking about laser systems, and I'm a friend of doing directed energy programs too. I just believe we can put the Brilliant Pebbles on the street almost, within a few years. And I think it'll take a little longer than that to have lasers in space.
And we need it yesterday, not on the street, but in space, ideally. Ambassador, let me ask you lastly one question that is dogging me. There now is growing alarm, I think it's fair to say, in the Pentagon and elsewhere about the emergence, not just in the Russian and Chinese arsenals, but they anticipate, apparently, in the not-too-distant future, in even countries like North Korea and Iran's, of what are known as hypersonic missiles and maneuvering missiles, which are designed, it seems, especially if you listen to Vladimir Putin, to defeat our existing missile defenses. What could we be doing that might give us a leg up on that beyond building our own hypersonic capabilities?
Well, I believe there are systems that could be improved if they don't have the capability today to intercept at least some of these systems. One of the easiest ways to get a maneuvering vehicle is to deploy MARVs, which are maneuvering vehicles from space, from ballistic missiles that are launched that reenter the Earth's atmosphere and then maneuver to avoid terminal and endo-atmospheric intercept. And there's no reason why we can't intercept those essentially almost immediately with capabilities. Our Brilliant Pebbles idea certainly could have dealt with them. I would hope that when we do the modification of some of the technologies and the software that we have, that we do a better job of what modern technology can achieve to build defenses against these systems as well. I have a real great confidence in Mike Griffin, who was my deputy for technology at SDI, and I know where he comes from on these issues, and he has stated publicly this is his top priority, and I believe I will deliver.
Yeah, he is, of course, these days the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. Ambassador Hank Cooper, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I hope you come back to us again very soon, sir. In the meantime, stay well.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's my pleasure to welcome once again a friend and very valued colleague. He is the editor of the Americas Report of the Center for Security Policy's Mengus Hemispheric Security Project, Dr. Luis Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman has been working on and reporting about Latin America for decades, and his insights, among other things, into what is going on in Venezuela are particularly appreciated. He is, after all, the author of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Era, the Threat to U.S. Security. Dr. Fleischman, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Like always, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Frank.
Good. Well, let's start with a piece that you've reported on at the Center for Security Policy's site about the Summit of the Americas, Luis. Two focuses were apparently their prime topics, Venezuela, as we mentioned, in the post-Chavez age, and more broadly, the problem of corruption. What came of the summit in those two regards?
Well, in terms of corruption, there was a big, statement coming from the presidents that actually were there, gathered there at the Summit of the Americas. But the reality is that there was not a similar statement, but kind of a similar statement issued in 1994, which was the first Summit of the Americas, about corruption. And the reality is that not much changed. I think the difference this year, things are changing now in Latin America, thanks to the work of the judges, particularly the judge in Brazil, Sergio Moro, that was able to fight a huge scandal, a huge scheme of corruption, and was able to have tremendous repercussions beyond Brazil. And for instance, and I mentioned several cases in Uruguay, the vice president resigned over a minor case of corruption. In Argentina, the former president, Cristina Kirchner, has been indicted.
And in Peru, the government has fallen in Peru.
Right. But unfortunately, there is still a way to go.
But let me ask you, Luis, about one other topic there, because as important as this is, and it's rife throughout Latin America, regrettably, is this problem in Venezuela. Did they do anything, or is there any hope for them doing anything about that, sick man of Latin America?
The reality is that there wasn't a consensus because there was resistance on the part of some of the beneficiaries of the Venezuelan government, and also certain countries that are so well in the left that didn't want to support a resolution on Venezuela, and one of them was Uruguay, my native country, unfortunately. But still, there was a group of 16 countries that actually signed an agreement or a declaration where they basically decided not to recognize the farce elections that Nicolas Maduro is planning for May, this coming May, and also made a call, which in my opinion is meaningless, to call to Venezuela to have free elections, to release the political prisoners and other things that the Venezuelan government will never do. But I think the most important thing is that there is a follow-up. Next month, on May 14th, there will be a number of people who will be meeting under the leadership of the United States. I think the work of Michael Pence was really good. They will meet again, and they will try to impose sanctions on Venezuela. The majority of Latin American countries have not yet imposed sanctions on Venezuela, with a few exceptions. But the good news is that the European Union imposed sanctions in Venezuela, and other countries outside the European Union also joined, like Switzerland.
Well, this is a long overdue step, and we'll watch closely for this next.
But the sanctions are far from enough, and Marco Rubio, for instance, opposes an oil embargo. And in my opinion, that's a mistake.
Yeah, mine too. Let me turn to one of the other countries that's in the news there at the moment, Luis Fleischman, and that is Cuba. We're being told that there's a new leadership there, a non-Castro named leader at that. Tell us about him and whether this really represents any change at all from the Castro brothers and their oppressive rule.
Well, this is a younger person, but he, at this point, is there are no signs, based on what he says, that he's going to make any change. But based on what I know from history, there is never a meaningful change as long as the old ruler is still alive. That happened in Russia with Stalin. You know, until Stalin didn't die, there were no changes. And the changes, of course, we know what they were. And the same in Franco's Spain. Franco was very sick for a long time, But the only time, you know, when the transition to democracy began was at his death.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. It seems as though there's another generation of Castros coming along who are going to be equally problematic in the intelligence service, among other things. But let's hope for the early demise of Raul Castro, that's for sure. Hey, Luis, quickly, one other topic that I did want to touch on quickly is just in the past couple of days, there's been some very dramatic developments in Nicaragua, a country that has been run by this kleptocrat and communist Daniel Ortega. What is going on there, as you see it, and what might come next? And more importantly, what should American policy be to try to help bring about change there?
Well, this is a very interesting development, because the riots and the demonstrations started when Daniel Ortega made a decision on social security reform that actually affected a large number of people. But the reality is that on Sunday, namely yesterday, Daniel Ortega actually backed off and decided, okay, since, you know, there are so many instances of violence and demonstrations, I'm going to back off. I will not impose that reform. But the reality is that the demonstrations continue. And they continue because they are asking for freedom. They are asking for an end to corruption and freedom of the press. Remember, Ortega is controlling that country through electoral fraud, through all kinds of arrangements that are mostly corrupt, and he has eliminated a lot of independent media outlets in Nicaragua. So I think what we are seeing in Nicaragua is basically a continuation of what we have seen in Venezuela. I think the demonstrations in Venezuela against the government are also inspiring the Nicaraguans, and I think that basically shows clearly the entire failure of the Bolivarian Revolution on all these left-wing revolutions that took place in the beginning of the millennia. Now they begin to decline. People demand freedom. People understand that social justice, as the way they put it, is not worth losing freedom. And I think what we are seeing is an important social movement that I believe Ortega is going to repress harshly. Already there are almost 30 people who have died in the clashes with the Nicaraguan security forces. You know, Ortega is attacking the universities, is attacking civilians, and I think we need to speak up. I think the administration of Donald Trump needs to speak up right away and impose sanctions on the government of Nicaragua.
So to recap, this brutally repressive government of Daniel Ortega that has been in power for on and off for decades, that has involved itself with all manner of corruption and narco-trafficking and the like, has backed off, but you believe that it's a temporary respite and that he will be using the control, the power of the state to punish those who have been not only protesting this social security reform business, but also more generally seeking to free themselves from his oppression. Is that correct, Luis Fleischman?
It's absolutely correct. And not only that, I expect blood, a lot of blood. This is what is going to happen, unfortunately. This is why I think we need the intervention of the international community.
Well, this is not something we've seen much of in connection with Venezuela, and I'm fearful that we won't see much of it here either in Nicaragua. But in both cases, as you say, this is a moment of opportunity, and I'd like to see our government more engaged in trying to take advantage of it. Luis, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do with us at the Mencus Hemispheric Security Project. Check out It's America's Report. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.